Okay, so moving forward a little bit, between 99 and the early 2010s.
So I should mention one other thing that I did that I'm very proud of, that was even earlier, and which is was very small, but I think was really pioneering. Was in 1992, I was hired to write the Landmarks designation, the Landmarks guidebook, to New York, and I had this idea. There had been little tiny guidebooks before, and they had very short entries on the historic districts. And I said, well, let's. We're not able to discuss really significant buildings because they're in the historic districts that were designated early on, so there are no individual landmarks. So how can we have a guide to New York City landmarks and not mention the Jefferson Market Courthouse, for example, or some of the incredibly spectacular churches in Brooklyn Heights by the most important architects in America? So I suggested that we, in the historic, some of the major historic districts, that we break out buildings. And so when I was doing Greenwich Village, I decided to sneak in some gay and lesbian sites. So I put in Stonewall, and I put in an apartment house on West 12th Street that I refer to as Lesbian Flats. And it was a number of women couples who were in the circle of Eleanor Roosevelt lived in this building. And I said, well, we'll see what happens. And it was all being edited by Marjorie Pearson, who was the director of the research department at Landmarks, and she was fine with it. So good for Marjorie that they weren't on the architectural level of Jefferson Market Courthouse or Upjohn's Church of the Ascension on Fifth Avenue, but she was fine with having this cultural overlay in there. So that was actually the first time that anything relating to landmarking in New York had any mention of any gay issue.
And you just wrote it and hoped for the
I
best?
just wrote it and hoped for the best. It's little. I mean, it's a small thing, but small things build up. So I think that kind of set a stage for the acceptance that, in landmarking, we can talk about these things.
So you think it kind of loosened the jar a little
I'm
bit?
hoping so. And then, then Jay Shockley and Gail Harris started adding LGBT overlays to a lot of their designation reports.
So, moving forward again, between like 1999, early 2000, and 2011, when you guys had this preservation conference where you talked about Beyond Stonewall, what kind of activities were going on in that time?
Ask that again.
So, in 99, you co-authored the Stonewall nomination. We talked
Right.
about that a little bit, so I'm
Yes.
skipping around, which is part
Yeah.
of the confusion. And then the next thing I have on my list is that you guys did a panel, Beyond Stonewall,
Oh, at the National
recognizing.
Trust.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of wondering, in the 10 years in between those, what kind of activities did you have going on?
Well, not many. We would talk because we're friends, and Jay and Gail were doing their thing at the Landmarks Commission, which was great. But we didn't do anything formally during that period. We wanted to. We always talked about how it would be great to do it, and then with the Beyond Stonewall, I think was really valuable because I can't remember, had we gotten our grant yet or
No,
not?
it was a few years
Yeah, it
beforehand.
was a few years before. Yeah, we were talking about the possibilities of doing this kind of thing, and that people should start thinking about that everybody's histories were being told, except for that our histories weren't being told, and that our sites were not being interpreted. And that was a big thing, is the interpretation of sites. We're very like house museums that were where clearly the person was gay or lesbian, but that was never mentioned. And so this panel, I think, was great because there was a pretty good sized audience in there, and I think it inspired people to think about that. I mean, we know that somebody from Kentucky was there, and they were very inspired, and then they applied for a grant, and there was somebody there from historic New England, and shortly, and they were also thinking about changing the interpretation of some of their houses. So I think that in its small way, it was an important event. And also, I think it was an important event because that the fact that the National Trust had this entire panel on this topic, I think, was really important, an important move in for a group that likes to be for all the people, but in many ways is also very conservative.
Had other cities or localities started doing projects like this of recognizing historic sites for their LGBT history?
Other people were thinking about that, but I don't believe that other cities were doing very much. Even I don't think that San Francisco, for example, had any LGBT-related landmarks yet.
So coming out of this conversation or from out of this panel, was that part of what inspired going after the grant in 2014?
Well, I think that what inspired us to go for that was that it was being offered. There was this grant there, and it was exactly for the type of thing that we had been wanting to do, but we never had the wherewithal to do it. And I think the timing was also good because Ken was sort of semi-retired. He still does his family business, but he had left the Kaplan Fund where he had been working, and Jay was retiring from his job at the Landmarks Commission, and so suddenly, there was the possible financing and the ability to actually do it, and so I actually called up my friends in the State Office of Historic Preservation and said, do you think this would fly? And they were very enthusiastic about it. And so we applied, and it was pretty last minute. I mean, basically Ken and Jay put together the nomination because I was, I think, grading final exams or something. And from what we understand, we were the highest rated application in the country. Maybe it's wishful thinking, but that's what we've been told.
So to hop back a little bit before we dive into this current project, I want to get a sense of your personal timeline, because you became a professor around 2008, 2009, is that right?
About then.
Tell me about that transition. How did that take place?
I'd been consulting, and I was really happy doing that, and I was an adjunct professor. I love teaching, and I had been teaching classes here at Columbia, both in the preservation program and a class about New York architecture for another program called The Shape of Two Cities, New York and Paris. And then suddenly a full-time position opened up in the preservation program. And I guess it was my midlife change. I decided I would go for it. If I wasn't going to do it now, when? And so I applied and I got the job. Then I became the director of the program for about 7 years, and I'm still a professor in the program. So, here I am, a tenured professor, which is not what I set out to do, because I never went the PhD route, so I wasn't expecting that I was going to be a full-time professor. And I loved what I was doing, but I just decided this was a new challenge.
Tell me about stepping into the academic world and how that was different for you.
It was different. I did have to give up a lot of my freelance work, but I still try to keep a finger in that, because I really believe that we're a professional school here, and we're training people to be out there in the preservation world. And I think it's important that the professors are out there in the preservation world, and that we know what's going on, and we're active in our communities. So I've kept that up. Besides all these things, the other thing that we haven't talked about is I'm also a writer. So I also write books. So that was also important. And I think that's how I got the job. I would never have gotten it right out of graduate school with my master's, but I had already published a number of award-winning books, and so that allowed me to do it. So now I do try to write more now, although there's not that much time, but that's what professors do, and I try to do a little bit of freelance work. I do an occasional National Register nomination, and I like giving public lectures and walking tours and things, because I like to get people interested and excited about the things I'm interested in and excited about.
How do you think you've been able to contribute to the field of preservation by working with students?
Well, I mean, it's incredibly fulfilling to be training another generation of preservation professionals. And to me, the most moving thing is to... I teach the students their first semester when they come in. They have two required courses that I teach, and I see them when they're young and new and they're just beginning to learn. And then I love to see them leave 2 years later as professionals. And it's just the most amazingly fulfilling thing. And then, you know, I bump into them at conferences, or they contact me because they have a question or something, and I find out all these great things that they're doing, and that they're all over the country and all over the world doing preservation, and what could be better?
So this, again, is another way that working with people and doing things for people has come to the fore. Yeah. Tell me about how the department had changed from when you were a student to when you became an adjunct and a professor.
There was a lot that was still the same here at Columbia. I mean, the basic foundation of the program, which is about architecture and the built world, was still very much there. And the idea that preservation is a diverse field. When I was a student here, we had to choose that either we were architects, conservationists, planners, or historians. And those were like the three fields within preservation that Fitch had chosen. And that was still very much a part of it, that we were going to be a program even though we're in the architecture school, that wasn't necessarily for architects, but could come to if you had an art history background or a history background or a journalism background or anthropology or really anything if you had a passion for preservation. And I think that is a real important foundation for the preservation program and the preservation field too. One of the things I did when I became director, the first thing I did was I got rid of the idea of having to choose one of those things, because I don't think that in the 21st century we do one thing. I mean, we all do lots of things. You know, I know a lot about building materials, but I'm not a hands-on conservationist. But it's important for historians to know about materials, or for planners to know about design issues. So we try to teach all those things, and the students can then focus in. But we try to be as diverse as possible. We've gotten much more. When I was here, it was really focused on the nuts and bolts of the building, the brick and mortar, and I think that cultural issues, by the time I came back, cultural issues were a lot bigger, and understanding architecture within larger urban contexts became much more important.
Those themes fit really well with your project of focusing on LGBT histories, mm-hmm. Because that's such a pressing issue for cultural preservation. And it seems like the LPC hasn't really changed over to that mode of thinking quite yet.
Well, I think, it was... The Landmarks Commission has been, I think, very slow to deal with cultural and historical landmarks. The law says that you can designate for architecture, history, or culture, but really, when I did an exhibit at the Museum of the City of New York that I co-curated with Donald Albrecht, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Landmarks Commission, I really looked at the designations and especially how the early designations came about, and mostly they were for architecture or a building that was very old. So vernacular buildings from the 17th century, got in. And that was basically it. And there were a few buildings over time where somebody really, really famous lived. So, Theodore Roosevelt's birthplace is a good example of that. And there was in the 1970s, I guess, a little flurry of interest in doing sites of African-American, of importance in African-American history. So all the major African-American churches in Harlem, for example, were designated. But that was just about as far as this kind of historical work had gone. So they hadn't done any LGBT sites, but they were equally behind in doing lots of other cultural sites. And I think the commission has always struggled with the idea of, well, how do we regulate sites that aren't architecturally distinctive? You know, they're used to looking at architecture. And I have always said that this is a completely bogus argument and that I see it as an excuse not to do it, because all you have to do is say, okay, we're going to try to regulate this so that change, so that what's the important period of significance of this building historically or culturally, and as change occurs, we're going to make sure that those features survive or are restored back, and that's it. It just doesn't seem to me to be a very difficult concept. But the commission has traditionally had difficulty with it.
And around, like, the early 2010s or, like, late 2000s is when people started talking about getting Stonewall landmark, not just on the National Register, but really protected.
Well, really, I have to say that Jay Shockley is the one and only force behind it. And it was through his being on the Landmarks Commission staff that he, in-house, was constantly harping on it. I think that there were people on the outside that wanted this, and it wasn't getting anywhere, but I really think that the credit goes to Jay for not letting up on this issue. And then I think it became politically expedient to do a gay-related site. And so, you know, Stonewall was the obvious first step in 1999, and so far it's been the only step.
Yeah.
But for Stonewall 50, we expect that to change.
So you talked a little bit about writing nominations, and I have here that you wrote the nomination for Julius's Bar and for Earl Hall, and also later amended the nomination for Alice Austin House. Can you talk a little bit about those projects?
So one of the things that the NYC LGBT Historic Sites Project is doing, besides our website, which is, you know, our major project, is that we're doing National Register nominations as well. And that was part of the grant that we got from the National Park Service, was to do a certain number of National Register nominations. And, you know, so when we started our project, I think there were two or three sites that had been listed on the National Register for LGBTQ significance. Now, today, in April 2019, we think that there are 21. Now, we could have missed, there may be some recent ones that we don't know about. But still, that's pretty pathetic when you think that there are like 93,000 sites listed on the National Register. So this is one, so we have now done five of those sites, Stonewall. And then I wrote three of them. Julius's Bar, which we did to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the so-called Sip-In. And we got it listed the day before the 50th anniversary of the Sip-In. So that was really thrilling. Do you want me to talk about the Sip-In, or is that...
Please do, as part of the significance of the place.
Yeah, so you know, so Julius is a bar in the village, and its history as a bar goes back to the 19th century. And the bar itself, as it currently exists, we think dates from the early 20th century. We can't find any evidence, but just from the aesthetics of it, my guess is it's from the teens or the 20s. I wish I knew more, but we just couldn't find that information. And it was in 1929 or 1930 that it became Julius's. So it opens as Julius's during Prohibition. And the only reason we know that is because it's not listed in the 1929 telephone book, and it's listed in the 1930 telephone book. So that is why we think it was founded then. And it was a straight bar, and it was a sports bar and a celebrity bar. And then in the 1960s, it began to attract gay men, most relatively conservative. It became a mixed bar, straight and gay. And I think that the fact that it was mixed and that the gay patrons were not flamboyant in any way, is probably what led to its survival when there were crackdowns on closing gay bars. It was written up sometimes as in publications. One 1964 guide to Greenwich Village said that it attracted the bar's audience was very attractive men and theater types. And so, you know, this was euphemisms that gay men would have understood what this meant. And there's this amazing book called New York Unexpurgated, which is basically a look into the nightlife and the less than acceptable nightlifes of New York. And there's a, and it's written by a, it's a pseudonym, Petronius, whom we where there's some evidence now that Petronius was a woman, and the section on gay bars is written in an incredibly insulting way. It's called the fag world, but it is incredibly knowing. So you know, you couldn't in the 1960s you couldn't get away with writing, getting a major publisher to publish a gay guide to New York. So it's couched in this very nasty language, but in great detail they go into each bar and what its audience is like. So you know exactly which bar you want to go to, and it talks about Julius's as attracting couples in the back and a significant collegiate group, many from gay colleges, which I love that idea. You know, who are they talking about? Gay colleges. I'm assuming it was Columbia was one of those, but so it was a mixed bar, and then. So that's one part of the story. Then we go to the state liquor authority's rule was that the mere presence of a homosexual was unruly, and that you couldn't knowingly serve a drink to somebody that was gay. So three members of the Mattachine Society decided that they were going to challenge this rule. And what they were going to do is get some reporters together, and they were going to go to a bar, and they were going to say that they were gay and they wanted a drink and wait to be denied service. And so they all met at a bar in the East Village on St. Mark's Place, the Ukrainian-American bar. And the newspaper reporters got there first, and they told the owner what was going on, and the owner closed the place. So that wasn't going to work. So everybody gets it. They go to the next stop. They decide to go to a Howard Johnson's. They ask the manager. They ask for the manager. The manager comes over. They say, "Well, we're homosexuals and we want a drink." And he laughs at them and serves them. And then that didn't work. So then they go across the street to a Polynesian place called the Waikiki, and the same thing happens. And they're not served. And then they go to Julius's. They decide to go to Julius's, and Julius's had been raided. And so they were very careful about what they did, because they could be closed down. So they go to the bartender and they say, "We're homosexuals and we want a drink." And there's this very famous photograph that Fred McDara took of the bartender putting his hand over a glass. Now the question is, was this spontaneous, did somebody tell the staff that this was going to happen and that it was staged? And Dick Leisch, one of the people that was there, changed his story over time. So we don't know for sure about that. But nonetheless, it got the publicity that they wanted. There's this spectacular photograph, first of all. And the New York Times did a piece, very nasty. And the Village Voice did a piece that was just great. And so it was out there. There were two other reporters. There were four reporters along, and I haven't been able to find the other two. Supposedly the New York Post wrote an article, but I scoured the New York Post, and I could not find it. It caused a bit of a scandal. The state liquor authority said, oh, they never had such a rule that you couldn't serve a homosexual a drink, which was a total lie. So it increased awareness of this really outrageous rule, and at the same time there were efforts to stop entrapment of gay men in bars. So these two things were sort of coming together to make make bar culture a little bit more welcoming. And so this was a major step on the road to the legitimization of gay and lesbian bars.
Can you talk about preserving bars as a way of preserving, as you said earlier, there were no gay spaces, there were spaces that then became?
Well, Julius's is a great example of that. It was a straight bar, it was a sports bar. It still looks today exactly like it did when it was a sports bar, the same horse race pictures and and celebrity photos are up there, and it transformed from a straight sports bar into a mixed bar into a gay bar.
And what about Earl Hall, which has sort of a similar...
So Earl Hall, it's here at Columbia, so that was a big thrill for me to write the National Register nomination for Earl Hall. Columbia has the oldest gay collegiate group in America that was founded in about 1965, and it was founded with the support of the chaplain's office, and the chaplain has his office in Earl Hall. So their early meetings of what was known as the Student Homophile League were in Earl Hall, and it was a very small group. They had the backing of the chaplain's office. They applied to be officially recognized as a student group, just like any other student group, and that was agreed to. And the next day, the founder, Stephen Donaldson, which was his pseudonym, Stephen Donaldson leaked this to the New York Times, and all hell broke loose because the alumni were not happy. And there's, in the Columbia archive, is a pile of the most homophobic letters about this. And the Columbia administration just didn't want, they just didn't need this. And they had just accepted this as any other student group. And they didn't expect that this was going to happen. And eventually it dies down. They don't stop the group from meeting. They had an agreement, though, that the Student Homophile League would not do social events. So there were no dances or anything like that. They had information panels. They would go to dorm floors and meet with students and talk about these issues. And they put out lots of sort of highly politicized broadsides on various issues. And so they existed for a number of years with their offices in Earl Hall. And then post Stonewall, they morphed into a much more activist group called the Gay Students at Columbia. And they started in 1970 holding first Friday of the month dances at Earl Hall in the ballroom of Earl Hall. And those were incredibly popular. They were really important alternative to going to the bars, and they attracted students, but they also brought in people from outside. They advertised in the Village Voice, so people came, and I interviewed lots of people that had gone to the dances, including Columbia students and people who were unaffiliated with Columbia, they grew into, by the late 70s, really major part of the gay social world. In New York, lots of people came, and they had a better sound system, and they were really, really important. And so the National Register nomination celebrates the Student Homophile League and the First Friday dances. And Columbia is putting up a plaque. In fact, we dedicated the plaque last week, and it isn't hanging yet. They're going to do some work in the building, so they decided not to hang it yet. But Columbia was very supportive of this project, and it's really thrilling for me as a Columbia grad and as a professor here to have a Columbia site listed.
I also want to ask about the Alice Austin House, because the amendments to nominations are a fairly recent phenomenon, right?
Well, amendments is not a recent phenomenon as an idea. I mean, people have amended nominations. Usually a nomination gets amended because the National Register usually requires a 50-year cutoff, and so early historic districts listed from the 1960s missed things that were less than 50 years old. So, for example, I know that Beacon Hill in Boston was amended so that you could do more recent history. But the idea of amending a nomination to reinterpret the significance of a site, especially from an LGBTQ perspective, that's what's new. And so we amended the Alice Austin House. The Alice Austin House, it was the home of the great photographer Alice Austin, one of the first women photographers on Staten Island, right on the water. It's a city house museum. And it was already listed on the National Register. It's a city landmark, and it talks about and it's listed because of its architecture. The house, parts of the house date back to the last years of the 17th century, and then it was turned into this picturesque Victorian cottage, and it's really very beautiful. And it mentions that, you know, Alice Austin, this really important photographer, lived there, but what it misses is that she lived there with Gertrude Tate for over 40 years, and that this relationship was really key to who she was. And she took a lot of really transgressive photographs of her women friends. There's one of my favorite photographs is Alice and two of her friends in male drag with a very pointedly placed umbrella. And you know, that's really key to understanding who Alice is. And so we have now reinterpreted that site. And we're not saying it's not important architecturally. Of course it is. But it also has another layer of importance. So we're sort of querying the architecture in a sense. And we're now also doing an amendment to the Church of the Holy Apostles in Chelsea, which is architecturally, it's a great church by Menard Lefevre with additions by Richard Upjohn. It was listed for its architecture, but it was also the site of meetings of lots of important gay and lesbian groups in the immediate post-Stonewall period. That's gone to New York State and is about to go about to be heard by the New York State Review Board.
Do you have other favorite sites or projects that were focused on during this time for the LGBT Sites Project?
Well, I think, you know, the LGBT Sites Project's big project is the website. So I think that's really what the major thing that we're all about. And that's so significant because it's out there for the public. That's why we're doing this. We're not just doing this because the three of us like this idea. We wanted to get this out and get people excited about that you could look at places that were familiar or unfamiliar with an LGBT lens, and that this was very powerful to see places where gay people and gay culture developed, and not just places of activism, you know, not just Stonewall or Julius's, but places that are crucial to the history and culture of New York and America. And I think that is the heart of what our project is all about, is getting this word out there and getting people involved with this, and to look at the city in a different way. I have developed a tour of the village, and one of my favorite places that I just started doing this a few weeks ago, and one of my favorite places on this is St. Luke's Place in Greenwich Village, which is a really beautiful block of spectacularly intact Italianate houses. And tour groups go down this street, and you know, you can stand there and you can talk about the Italianate row house and all the details on it. And if you want, and if people talk about people that lived on the block, traditionally it's that Mayor James J. Walker lived on the block, and mayor's houses have two lamps in front of them, and you can see the two lamps where James J. Walker did. But this also was a really important place where a lot of gay people owned houses, where one of the sort of arts power couples of the early decades of the century, Monroe Wheeler and Glenway Westcott had a townhouse, and Marion Moore lived in the basement, and Arthur Lawrence, who was the librettist for West Side Story and Gypsy, had another house, and Paul Cadmus and Jared French and some other artists had another house. So, you know, there's a whole different way of looking at this block, and it just makes it so much richer. And it's not that the architecture is not important, but there are other levels, other layers that you can see in this block.
How do you think creating this online resource of this map will change attitudes in the preservation field or contribute to changing?
Well, I think one of our hopes is that there will be more and more preservation around LGBT sites, not only on the National Register level, but on the local level as well. And I think there will be some local landmarks relating to gay issues in time for Stonewall 50. I think that is going to happen. And I think, you know, we've been discovering sites and we've been advocating for sites. So we want both to identify sites and interpret sites and preserve sites. And we don't think that all the sites that we've discovered are going to be preserved. And in fact, several sites that we have on our website, one has been demolished and the other's in the process of being demolished. And it's sad, but we understand that that's going to happen, that every site is not going to be preserved, but at least we have preserved the knowledge and of that site. We've photographed the site, and people will know that it's important, and I guess we'll splash a demolished on it in hopes that other sites will not be demolished, that there will be more sites that become city landmarks or that are listed on the National Register.
Are there any losses that bother you in particular?
Well, the one building that's been lost is the Paradise Garage, which was a major disco, which I only was in once. But it was really important in both the pre-AIDS culture, and then it was the site of one of the first huge fundraisers around AIDS, and that's the only time I was at the Paradise Garage was for that event. So you know, was really important in the history of gay men getting together to deal with the AIDS crisis. And so I think that's kind of sad. Also, it had a very large minority crowd that you went to the Paradise Garage. And so, you know, there aren't a lot of places that were extant to which African American and Hispanic men went to. So I think that was kind of sad that this was lost. And then the building on 14th Street that's coming down now was an early home of the Gay Activists Alliance, which is a really important post Stonewall organization.
What do you think is next, or what do you hope for the future of growing the LGBT Sites Project?
Well, first, our biggest hope is that we can continue. You know, when we founded this, we wanted to make it at least to Stonewall 50. But now, you know, we've gotten this going, and it's been so exciting and so fulfilling. And you know, we've won some awards, and we really want to continue. So the first thing is that we have to find the money to continue this. So I think that is a primary issue. We have about 160 sites on our website now. We're hoping it'll be up to 200 by Stonewall 50. But we have several hundred more sites. Either sometimes we have the site, or sometimes we have the person or the event that we don't have the location yet. But so we want to really continue with this, because it's not a finite thing. We want to continue to get people interested and involved with this, and we hope that to inspire a younger generation to do this. And that's particularly important because I think people tend to not know that there is this rich history of LGBT life in New York, and we want to make sure that people know that, you know, that LGBT history didn't begin with Stonewall. There's a lot of history before that, and I think it's important that younger generations are aware of that, or are aware of the early gay liberation issues, or aware of the AIDS-related issues, and so we just want to continue going and doing what we're doing, and you know, doing it better.
Do you have a sense for who accesses the site or how it gets used?
No. I know it's. I know we've been getting very good traffic on the site. I think I heard that we've been getting over like 50,000 hits a month. But Ken Lusbader will be able to tell you that. But people, you know, people tell us that they've found things on the site, and so I think that, you know, what's crucial, of course, is we're not doing this just for us. We want people to be on the site, so it's getting word out, and this, our social media has been very effective. I think we have a good number of followers, and getting people to use the site is really important.
Have you noticed similar projects happening in other places? Have you been able to inspire similar projects?
Not yet. There have been theme studies that have been done, and you know, we're seeing this. I mean, we're not the only thing that's going on in the country, so that in Los Angeles and in San Francisco, there have been theme studies, and there are a few landmarks, and there are a few buildings up on websites about Los Angeles from the Los Angeles Conservancy. There's a Kentucky theme study. There's a Maryland theme study that's being done now. So other people are doing things, but we haven't seen anything as comprehensive as what we're doing yet. And I think that we're really pioneering in doing a comprehensive survey of sites of LGBT significance in the broadest definition of that. And we're hoping that we'll inspire other people to do it. But, you know, first of all, you have to have the time, and you need a little bit of funding to get it going.
So you're not only making a history that was previously visible, but you're tacking it to a landscape, a built environment that people can see. How do you think that impacts people's lives?
Well, that's, I think, the most important thing for us. That defines what we are, that we're not just a history project, but we're a built world physical history project. And as preservationists, we all feel that place is a very powerful thing. To be able to stand someplace and see the building where some event took place or some person lived of significance is a lot more powerful than seeing a little plaque that says so-and-so lived in the building that formerly stood on this place. And, you know, maybe they lived in a little shack and there's a 50-story building on the site. So that's not as meaningful to I think, as this is the place where it occurred. And so that is our focus. All of our sites are extant sites. And I think that to us, that's key. As preservationists, as all of us who are trained in place, that is crucially important.
You described earlier in the interview, you know, walking into the Tenet Museum and learning about that being like a life-changing event for you. Have you been able to see maybe students of yours or other people have similar interactions with some of these sites?
I see a growing interest in queer history. I have a thesis this year on lesbian bars. I've had a thesis a few years ago that looked at how gay and lesbian people were interpreted at house museums, where the person being discussed was gay or lesbian, and looked at Walt Whitman, Eleanor Roosevelt, Alice Austin, and a few other people, so there is a growing interest, I think, in this, and even this year we're doing a studio that focuses on social inclusion in the Columbia neighborhood. And there's a lot of interest in LGBTQ among the students, and not necessarily among the gay students. It's just something that a younger generation in particular is very interested in, this issue. And I think, you know, for younger people, especially if you grew up in one of the more liberal parts of the U.S. or Europe, they don't even understand the issues of discrimination. And so, you know, it's kind of eye-opening for them to learn about that, about the history of this. They're basically completely accepting that they're, you know, what's the problem? So they've been really interested. One of the students actually sent me, was doing research on Riverside Church and wrote up a little entry for our website, so that we're going to put up, because it was just part of the research she was doing, and she said, "Wow, this is great! I'm gonna put this on the site."
That's marvelous. Would you like to reflect a little bit on the changes that have taken place in the world between Stonewall 50 and Stonewall 25?
Well, there are changes that have been good and changes that have not been so good. I think that in our little bubbles, like New York and San Francisco and London and places like that, you know, it's just so accepted. 25 years ago, I could be walking down the street with my now husband and be somebody driving by in a car yelling faggot to us. That doesn't happen anymore in New York. I don't know anybody that's had, I'm sure it does a little bit, but it doesn't happen in the way that it used to. Of course, gay marriage is the most obvious change. So I think that places, certain places, LGBT issues are accepted as part of the conversation. But that, of course, is not the case everywhere in the world. It's certainly not the case everywhere in the United States. It was very interesting that we held a symposium here the day before yesterday on LGBTQ site preservation, and we had the lead author of the Kentucky theme study come and speak. And you know, I wanted somebody from a place that was less obvious, and you know, it was just amazing that Kentucky did this. But what you know, what she said that I hadn't really thought about was at the time they did this, Kentucky had a Democratic governor. And now he was defeated by a Tea Party candidate. So they now have a Tea Party government. And so the proposals that, the things they proposed in this theme study are not being acted upon because the political climate is just not right for that in Kentucky anymore. And so sometimes things, you know, progress doesn't always move, everything doesn't move forward in a progressive way. And, you know, there are places in the world where, of course, we could not have had that symposium, and you and I couldn't be sitting here discussing all these issues. You know, I could be stoned to death in Brunei, and gay people are being scapegoated in Poland and other places in Eastern Europe. So I've seen things get better, and some things either unchanged or, in fact, have gotten worse, because now that LGBT issues are talked about, it's easier to scapegoat them. You know, probably nobody even talked about gay issues publicly in Poland 25 years ago, but now it's in the public discourse, so it can be used as a negative thing. So, I mean, I live in a world where it's just a part of people's lives. And everybody's so excited about our project, you know, you don't have to be gay to think our project is great here in New York.
What are some of the challenges that you see moving forward to seeing more sites designated specifically for LGBTQ reasons?
In New York or anywhere?
Well, in New York, since that's where you're working.
Well, I think that a case has to be made for the designation of any site. So, you know, we have to make a case that particular sites are really important. And more than just kind of like average importance, so more than just, this was a gay bar here. I think this that the government is open to it, so I'm optimistic. And I certainly think getting things listed on the National Register is fine. And you know, even in the federal political climate, sites are getting listed on the National Register. The staffs at these agencies are just continuing to do their jobs.
If you could send any advice to yourself back in time from when you were first getting started, not just on this project, but on, you know, OLGAT or anything else, what advice do you think you would give yourself?
Oh, I don't know. I always tell people that if I had to live my life over again, I'd do it in exactly the same way. So, you know, we just did it. And, you know, sometimes you do things and maybe we weren't thinking about, are we going to get any negative feedback from doing that old guide map? Never occurred to us. And we didn't. I mean, it was all positive. And I have no regrets. And I can't think of another way I would have done it.
What about advice you might give people who are just getting started now, possibly just in the preservation field more generally?
I think people should follow their passions, and if you know everybody has to make a living, and work at your job, but then if you have a passion, do it. You know, do it on the weekends and do it in the evenings, and make a difference. I think that's what's really important. That's what we preservationists should be doing, is making a difference.
Do you have a plan for all your notes and records and research regarding this project?
Yes, Columbia is getting everything.
Really?
Yes.
That's already been established.
I've already decided. No, I also am a, I have a huge collection of rare ephemera about New York, and that it's all coming to Columbia.
Tell me about that collection of ephemera.
I collect paper ephemera about, you know, because everything I do is about New York. You know, I write about the architecture of New York, and the LGBT project is focused on New York, and I collect books and paper ephemera about New York that relate to the built world. And so that'll all go to the rare books library here, and all my whatever papers of mine they want, they are are theirs.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, that was my last question. Is there anything I should have asked you about? Anything in particular?
I don't think so. That was very comprehensive.
Good. Well, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
And I look forward to being in touch as we kind of wrap this up.
Good.